Hello, welcome to the House of Comments. This is a weekly podcast where we talk about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem blogger, but I'm okay now. It is the 100th episode of this podcast. So this is a bit of a special edition where not only do we have all three of us current co-hosts. So that's myself, Emma Burnell. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
And hi, and also Nick Dennis. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
But also we have, as a very special guest, Stuart Sharp, who used to co-host this podcast with me when we started way back in 2009 for, I think, the first 37 episodes. So good evening, Stu.
Hi, Mark. How's it going?
Yeah, good. Good to have you back. What have you been doing in the last few years then, since you were last involved?
Having children, mostly, I guess.
I see.
Writing iOS apps.
Right, okay. So not really involved in politics much at all then?
Not even slightly, no.
Okay, well, it'd be good to get a perspective of a non-politico, because we don't normally have them on. So welcome anyway, welcome back.
That's strange for a political podcast.
And also, I'm delighted to say that we are also joined by the chap who was our first ever guest on our first ever episode, and that is Ian Dale. Good evening, Ian.
Hi.
Hi. Ian was a prominent Tory blogger a few years ago when we first had him on, but he's now scaled the heights of being the LBC Drive Time presenter. And in fact, LBC's just gone national as well, so we're Drive presenter on the only national talk radio show.
Yep, we did that a couple of weeks ago. We're now getting calls from Scotland and Wales and goodness knows where else.
Yeah.
Have they changed what L stands for?
Pardon?
Because L was London, wasn't it? So is it
yeah, we used to be London's biggest conversation. We're now leading Britain's conversation.
Yeah, fantastic.
And actually, didn't it used to be London Broadcasting Corporation? So I'm not sure there's ever been a company that's had three different things in which its letters have stood for. That's
well, there's a long story behind that. There was some court dispute with Mohammed Fayyad, so probably we're better off not discussing that.
Okay, yes.
Fair enough. Okay. Yeah, we don't want to piss Mohammed Al Fayyad off, so let's not do that.
Actually, I do. I hate him.
Well, yeah, we probably all do, but I can't afford it.
Yeah, I can't either. Okay. All right. Well, the first topic that we thought we would talk about today is a story that's been rumbling on for a while. In fact, it has been rumbling on for a few years, but it's only really come to prominence in the last week or so. And that is the story about predominantly Harriet Harman and also Jack Dromey, who were members of an organisation called the National Council for Civil Liberties back in the 1970s and I think early 80s, which is actually what is now Liberty. Or at least it devolved into Liberty. And the potential scandal here is that there was another organisation called the Paedophile Information Exchange, which was in some way affiliated with the NCCL. And this has now blown up into a big story because the Mail's gone heavy on it in the last few days. And then various other media have piled in as well. And there's been various talk about, will Harriet Harman apologise? And she didn't quite apologise. Then she said she regretted it. Patricia Hewitt, who was actually a more senior member of the NCCL, has apologised. Emma, can we start with you? What do you think about this story? I mean, do you think this is just the Mail stirring up trouble, or do you think that there's actually something in it?
I don't think there's anything in it in terms of, you know, is Harriet Harman an apologist for paedophilia? No, don't be stupid. And it is odd because, as far as I can tell, there are no new details to the story that have moved it from, you know, what was reported in 2009, I think, originally. Certainly it's been kicking around for a long time and has suddenly put it back on the front pages. I'm not sure there's anything new that's come out. It's a very difficult story. One of the things that I read on Twitter, there's a link to a story where William Hague was being accused of a cover-up when he was Welsh Secretary. And my thought immediately was not, oh good, there's a story from the other side now, but how awful for people who are victims of paedophilia that what we're doing now is just using these stories against each other to try and knock chunks out of our political opponents, and once again completely forgetting the victims and what's best for them. And you know, it's happening on both sides. It happens all the time. It's happened to the Liberal Democrats through the way that people talk about Cyril Smith. It happened very high profile with you know, false accusations against Lord Faulkner. Now you've got the sort of tying of Harriet Harman and Jack Dromey to the paedophile scandal in the late 70s. lots of stuff about Thatcher and being good mates with Jimmy Savile, and now this William Hague thing. And instead of thinking, what can we do to change the culture? What can we do to make social services work better? What can we do to protect victims? What we're doing is going, you're really bad, and we've got a really bad thing we can say about you. And I that really depressed me this afternoon.
That's not true, though, is it? Because I don't think that I haven't heard a single Tory politician try to make political capital out of this. There may have been some. I just haven't seen them. This is a Daily Mail smear campaign. It's nothing more than that. I hear what you say about sort of this being a political football, or this general subject being a political football. But I honestly don't think that that is the case in here.
Can I just come in? Apparently, a central office, Conservative central office, sent round a message to all Conservative MPs saying, do not go in on this story, sort of stay away from it. So I'm not saying any of them would have done anyway, but it's definitely the Conservative Party definitely aren't treating this as a potential opportunity to knock Labour.
Stu, as a kind of political,
it's more the activists who are tearing chunks out of each other.
Yeah, Stu, as a political outsider, I mean, how is this story registered with you? I presume you were aware of the story.
Yeah, I remember. I saw it come out. It struck me as a bit. I mean, you're just pointing fingers at each other, really. I kind of agree with Emma on this one. It's not really a major story to my mind. You know, there's a lot bigger things happening in the world than what one member of the Labour Party may have done, 20 years ago, and what group they were part of. And I think it's kind of pointless as a story, because it doesn't actually, like, even if Harriet Harman was kind of actually fronting this organization, which it doesn't, she wasn't anywhere near it, really. That doesn't change anything about where she is now, really. Mm. So it just strikes me as a fairly pointless kind of exercise in pointing fingers and saying, oh, it's a bit like the whole, oh, well, such as so-and-so smoked weed when they were in school kind of story. It's, any kind of, in a sense, you're breeding this kind of, you're continuing on this kind of sense of, well, anybody who's in politics has to have lived their entire life whiter than white. There can't possibly be anything in their past, because, she's not actually done anything, obviously I wasn't a big fan of the Labour Party when they were in power, but she hasn't done anything criminal or, severely wrong now.
Apart from what happened when she had that car crash and then drove off, but maybe we'll gloss over that.
we'll ignore that one. But that's exactly what I mean. That's an actual story of somebody who's done something right now.
It was a few years ago, but more recent, and
far be it for me to defend Harriet Harman, but I'd had her on doing an hour's phone-in about 3 weeks ago, and someone phoned in and asked her about this, and she gave her version of the events, and it's not quite the version of events that you would have read in the Daily Mail, let's put it that way.
Fair enough. Well, actually, Ian, I was gonna ask, because you covered this story, not the car crash story, the other story, on your show recently. What was kind of the general feeling from callers? I mean, does this seem like a storm in a teacup that will just go, it will go away in a few days?
Well, I actually said on my, I wrote a blog post on this, and I mean, I don't do an awful lot of blogging nowadays, but I was so outraged, really, at what the Daily Mail had done. I mean, I don't really agree with Harriet Harman on anything, but I do believe in fairness in public life. And it's quite clear to me that this is yet another part of the Daily Mail smear campaign against the leadership of the Labour Party. They tried it on Ed Miliband last year. They're now doing it on Harriet Harman. And in her case, I'm pretty sure it's all motivated by her response to the Leveson inquiry. So I wrote about it. I just sort of bashed off a 10-minute blog on the train. And then I had the 2-hour dental appointment. And I came out and found that I was the number one trending thing on Twitter, which last time that happened to me was slightly more unfortunate, but we'll gloss over that one.
Yeah, we don't talk
about
that.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. So did everyone else. I mean, I just think that this is outrageous by the Daily Mail. I mean, people might say, well, I've got an axe to grind here because I've been done over by the Daily Mail. I took them to the Press Complaints Commission once and lost. And maybe that colours my judgment a little bit on this. But does anyone seriously think that Harriet Harman, who was a relatively junior employee, I think she was about 25 years old, a legal officer at the NCCL, did she control what the NCCL did? Did she control its policies? Of course she didn't. Now, if you want to have a go at anyone, have a go at Patricia Hewitt. But of course, Patricia Hewitt is no longer important because she's no longer an MP, no longer part of the Labour Party leadership. I mean, yeah. she actually wrote a piece saying that she believed that the age of consent should be 10. Now, I'm quite happy to have a debate with her about that. But I just think that Harriet Harman is being vilified. Now, she hasn't helped herself. Let's be fair. Her response to this has been fairly cack-handed in terms of media management. But she still doesn't deserve the 4 days on the front page, the constant association, the words in the headlines, Labour, paedophilia, Harman. We all know sort of what this is. This is the Goebbels principle of PR.
Mm. Guilt by association, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nick, what do you think about this?
Well, obviously, I agree with what everyone said. And on a more positive note, YouGov published a poll today where only 6% of people thought that Harriet Harman was a pro-paedophile person. So even though the Daily Mail have been leading on this for the last couple of weeks, the vast majority of the British public can see what it is, which is essentially a personal vendetta.
But
against,
to be honest, if I was Harriet Harman, the fact that 6% of people think she's pro-paedophilia, I mean, that's horrible for, you know, more than...
Yeah, well, maybe about 2% of those couldn't read the form. And you always get 3 or 4% who'll always go off on one way or the other. I think it's absolutely terrible. I mean, I'm a conservative. I disagree philosophically a lot of what Harriet Harman stands for, but I really respect her as a politician and what she's achieved and her drive. And you know, she has a mission that she's basically worked very, very hard to try and achieve, which is getting more women towards the top of public life. Now, I don't agree with many of her methods, but that's, you know, that's an argument we need to have about the policy. I mean, attacking her as a person is completely nonsensical, and I don't really understand why the Daily Mail is going after her at a time when the post-Leveson settlement still isn't actually secure. So it's almost like they're trying to shoot themselves in the foot, really.
I'm sure Paul Dacre has his reasons for doing what he's doing. But I was quite interested in what you were saying there, Ian, about Harriet Harman and Jack Jeremy being relatively junior people within the NCCL.
Well, she was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, fair enough, Harriet Harman. But you see this time and again. I mean, the amount of times that Gordon Brown got up at the dispatch box and had a pop at David Cameron for Black Wednesday, when David Cameron was just a junior advisor to Norman Lamont at the time. This sort of thing just happens all the time in politics. People who have been, you know, involved in things are brought to account for things that happened when they were, like, you know, in their teens or 20s. And it's, you know, I think it is ridiculous, but I think it's pretty clear we all basically agree that this is a pretty horrible thing that the Mail have done, this smear. And I'm not sure there's much mileage in talking about it much more, unless anyone has anything else to add before we move on.
Emma.
Go on, Emma.
Just to say that at the special conference yesterday, which I know we're probably going to go and talk about later, the one of the longest sustained moments of applause was for Harriet. So if the Mail think that they've got even close to dispatching her from her democratically elected position as deputy leader of the Labour Party, they've got a very long number of things coming. She's quite a divisive figure often in the Labour Party, but not yesterday. There was 100% support in that room for her.
Good stuff.
By the way, does anyone know if the Daily Mail's ever apologised for supporting fascists in the 1930s?
I don't think so.
Oh.
No.
So I just have one other thing to say on this, in a sense. One of the most surprising things to me about the whole story was just the clear difference in times that this took place in as well. Because, you know, we can criticise Harriet Harman now or whatever, but you got to think, at the time, there was a campaign group called Paedophile Information Exchange, and that wasn't illegal.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, you're talking about a completely different sort of... state of mind to how we think of things now. You know.
Well, this is quite interesting, because I don't think anybody trying to change the law, it should be made illegal. Obviously, no one should be allowed to break the law, but somebody should be allowed to campaign.
No, but if I set up a campaign group now, if I set up a campaign group now called Paedophile Information Exchange, I imagine I'd be on the wrong side of the law fairly quickly.
I don't know. I think you'd probably be, obviously, PR-wise, I don't think it'd be your best move. But
depends what information you're exchanging.
Yeah, I mean, there was an episode of Peep Show, I don't know if anyone on here has seen it, where Superhands wants to name the band that they're forming Free the Pedos. And, and that is obviously seen as just like a completely beyond the pale idea. And yet I got the same feeling as Stu when I heard about this organisation. How could there have been an organisation called the Paedophile Information Exchange and for it to have existed and been, you know, admitted to polite society in the way that it seems to have been? It
got government grants.
Yeah, it does seem very strange, but I think it does indicate it was a different world. I was hearing someone talking about Jimmy Savile's autobiography that he wrote in, I think, the 70s. And there's sections in there that talk about all these antics that he got up to. And although he's a bit hazy about the exact age of the women that he was, that he was fooling around with, there are various stories about their parents coming and banging on the caravan door and, you know, them having to escape out of a window and stuff. And it's all seen as kind of, you know, bawdy hijinks.
There is a legitimate debate here, though, which politicians can't have. And this is, I suspect, one of the reasons why Stuart has gone off politics. And to an extent, it's why I've become very frustrated with politics, in that I wrote a piece not that long ago about why prostitution should be legalised. I could not have written that had I still been involved in active politics. If I wanted to write an article about why I think the age of consent should be reduced to 14, which I'm not sure I do, but if I did write that, I could not do it as a serving politician. If I wanted to write an article about legalising drugs, it's very, very few politicians would actually have the courage to do that. And I think that is a crying shame, where people who hold profound views, and they may be distasteful to some people, but if you hold a view, you should be able to at least articulate it.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, I think on that agreement, we should move on. And Emma, you mentioned about the Labour special conference, which was all about changing the voting system within the party and I think other things as well. Do you want to fill us in on how that went and your thoughts on what's happened?
Yeah, it was a very short, it wasn't a one day conference. It was sort of half a day conference in the middle of the day, so that people coming from further away, because it was in the XL Centre in East London, which I'd never been to before. So people coming from further away from London could get there on time. And it was about a number of different rule changes on how Labour's relationship with individual trade unionists. So in the past, unions would say, we've got X amount of members to affiliate to Labour. And they retained all the data about who they were. That never went to the party. So when there was a leadership election, for example, unions would send out ballot papers rather than that coming through the party. Union people would opt in to the political fund on joining, but would not be asked for, I think, a decade whether they were going to continue to be opted to want to affiliate to the Labour Party. So rather than automatic affiliation, which is what's happened now, under the new rules, a member of a union will be asked if they want to affiliate to the Labour Party. And if they do, that relationship will be held by Labour Party Central Office rather than by the union. They will have to pay an additional fee, which is part of their union membership dues, but it goes in a different direction. They have to opt in twice, basically. They opt in to be interested and to pay into the political fund, and then they opt in specifically to be an affiliated member of the Labour Party. So that's one of the things that have changed. The other is that we have now moved to a system of one member, one vote for the leadership, or one member or affiliated supporter, one vote, which is a slightly longer and more complicated acronym that I haven't yet worked out. But it's essentially OMOV, which will make a difference in terms of how the leadership elected. That is now implemented immediately. The trade union members who join from today onwards will join under the new system. And over a period of the next 5 years, anyone who is currently a trade union member and is considered affiliated to Labour will have to be moved over or decide not to move over. And we're going to have a primary for London. I think those are the big key, a closed primary for our candidate for London Mayor. I think those are the big three key changes that are happening.
Yeah, and it got 86%. Primary?
It's only Labour members, it's not a primary.
I think it's Labour members and registered supporters. So it doesn't seem like a primary to me, but I'm not. It's a closed primary, which I'm not entirely sure how that's different from what we did last time. But
it's ridiculous. What are they afraid of, people?
I think what they're afraid of is that in a primary for 7 million people would be prohibitively expensive.
Well, it's funny because they managed to do it in California, don't they?
They have a lot more money in politics in California. All you need is two Hollywood directors.
Well, they did it in the Socialists did it in France, and what they did is they charged everybody £1 who wanted to vote.
Oh, could you imagine that here?
Yeah.
it worked in France. Well, apart from they got Hollande, who's not doing so great in government. But as a system, that sort of seemed to work.
Yeah, and Emma, you spoke from the stage at the conference.
I did. I spoke on behalf of the Socialist Societies, which I represent on the National Policy Forum.
Okay, so do you think that's why it got 86%? You think it would have been like maybe 70 or something, and you just kind of, you know, tipped it?
I think I brought at least an extra, you know, 10-15%.
Yeah,
I killed in the run.
Excellent. Well, you know, it's a psychologically important 86% barrier that he's got over now. So I think, you know, I think these changes are here to stay.
I think the thing is that we can joke about the 86% now, and it does seem a little bit, you know, kind of one-sided. But you forget that when he first announced it, people were absolutely unsure whether he'd managed to do it. And it was, you know, there was
that was excellent expectation leadership. Management, though, Emma, wasn't
then
it?
Then secondly, when he decided to do it with a special conference, that was considered a massive mistake because it is basically, you know, shit or bust. And if he hadn't managed to get that through, he would have been in, you know, it would have been the end of his leadership. Yeah. So you forget how concerned people were a year ago that this wasn't going to work.
Nick,
especially conservatives, if it was going to be the end of his leadership.
Nick, what do you think about this from a kind of conservative perspective?
I don't know much about the details, but I have a feeling that Labour have done the right thing because political party membership across all parties is plummeting, and this is a great way of them suddenly increasing their membership list. Even if only 10% of union members sign up for this, then they get an extra I don't know how much it is, 500,000. 600,000 members, 700,000 who they can have direct contact with, and I think that's absolutely fantastic for them. At the 2010 general election, one of the things I noticed is that while the Conservatives had a lot of money, a lot of glossy leaflets and a lot of billboards, Labour actually had a very, very effective ground campaign. And that's because they got a lot of people who are affiliated with unions but not members of the parties to go out and knock on doors. So they were already using this extra sort of people force. And I think in built-up areas, especially in London and other urban areas, that really helped stop the swing against Labour and helped, you know, force the Conservatives to go into coalition by not winning enough seats. So I think this is probably, you know, I don't know if this was intended, but I think actually this matches the way society is moving and how people engage in politics, really. Also, I don't really think it will cause too many problems for Labour. So if I'm a member of a union and I decide not that my political contribution shouldn't go to Labour, well, my union probably will spend it on a campaign which is Labour friendly anyway, such as Against the Cuts. So I don't really think Labour lose particularly either way. So, I think they've probably done a good thing here.
Ian, what do you think?
I'm completely bored by the whole thing, to be honest. I don't think anybody in the real world actually understands what Ed Miliband has really done. I'm not sure I can. I understand the detail.
We'll ask a real world person.
I'm not sure anyone really understands how Ed Miliband got elected to leader, though, either. So I think in that sense, you know, next time they do a leadership campaign, I think that they'll have a lot less people being confused about what's actually going on.
Okay.
I didn't mean to end the conversation.
Yeah, you stunned us all out there, Stu. I don't think there's anywhere else to go. Okay.
No, I think from the outside, it is just moving things around, moving pieces of paper around. I don't think...
I mean, is it slightly surprising it's taken until 2014 for Labour to have one member, one vote? I'll just throw that out there.
I don't think it's surprising if you think of the history of the federated structure of the Labour Party. You know, it wasn't until the 1980s that we actually had an electoral college. Before that, it was just MPs who elected a leader.
Mm.
And then it was the 90s that we moved to... a different system again, and your different rules for conference. So these are hard changes to make internally. It may not look like it from the outside, but this is quite a huge shift internally in the way that power works in the Labour Party. So, which then makes a difference to what you can do in terms of your external messaging. And the other thing that we can do in terms of our external messaging, because we've been being bashed for, well, certainly since Ed became leader and for longer, much longer before that, about being in the pockets of the trade unions and they're being our paymasters. And I think we can now turn around and say, well, we've sorted out our funding, mates. What about you, Dave?
Nick, do you think that there's any likelihood that the Tories will think, Labour have sorted out their funding problem, so maybe we should now too, and let's play fair about this? Or do you think they'll just bank it and quite happily have several
Well, I think it won't change any of the anti-union rhetoric at all. I don't think the Conservatives are going to look at their internal structures anytime soon, unfortunately, because I think they could be improved quite a lot. I agree. Most people completely bored by this don't understand it. Not important in terms of on the leaflet it's going to make any difference to anything. But I do think in terms of how they organise themselves as a party and the amount of manpower that they'll have to call on, I actually think this will make quite a big difference to their how they operate compared to the Conservatives. Because I think the way the Conservatives are going is that we're just going to end up with rich donors and public affairs professionals and a very narrow base of membership. And at the moment, I don't see any way that CCHQ are thinking about opening up a bit and having sort of like affiliated membership or allowing, even though they do, but sort of that grey area, people can be involved with the Conservative Party, but not be members. They don't really get that that's how people do politics now. And I think by Labour doing this, they're actually going to be operating in a more sort of open way, which is more in tune with how society sort of sees issues now. And I think that'll benefit Labour.
Given the average age of your membership, Nick, isn't the grey area the membership themselves?
Thank you very much. Are you here all week, Emma? So we're going to move on to our final question, which is about, there were reports earlier this week that David Cameron was considering putting a clause in the Conservative manifesto for the 2015 general election, ruling out completely any possible coalition. Now, I think since then there's been denials from Number 10 that is what's been going on. And it also seemed to spark a debate in Labour as well about whether they should rule out a coalition. Ian, if we start with you, what do you think about this? Do you think, regardless of whether this is true or not in terms of the story, do you think it would be a wise thing for either the Tories or Labour to rule out a coalition absolutely in this way? Do you think there's an advantage in doing that?
There's an advantage in keeping some of your own supporters on side. In David Cameron's case, people on the right, and Ed Miliband's place, people on the left. But if you look at the polling on this, Lord Ashcroft has done some quite interesting polling on whether coalitions are popular. And you might be surprised to find out that actually the coalitions in general are more popular among the electorate than single party governments. And even this coalition, which from all you sort of read in the media, you'd think everyone hated, it isn't actually as unpopular as people think. So I thought it was an interesting kite to fly, and I suspect that's exactly what it was, just a kite flying exercise. And I think it would actually shake up the whole election campaign if David Cameron did that. I have to say, I don't expect him to do it. But on the other hand, I also think that it would be very difficult for him to do a coalition after the next election, partly because of internal party management reasons. So I wouldn't rule out him doing it, but I think it's probably unlikely. But I don't see a coalition with the Liberal Democrats after the next election, because I think the Liberal Democrats are going to be sort of maybe not obliterated, but they're going to be a fraction of the size that they are now, probably down by about 50%.
Emma, do you think that Labour are likely to try and do something like this?
I think it would be bonkers if we did. That's not to say I think that we should go into coalition if we didn't achieve a majority. I think there are real problems with that. But I think ruling that out before any election, if you look at who Labour are attracting in terms of our vote share, a lot of them are former Liberal Democrats. And I'm guessing that those people would be more open to the idea of coalition in general, if not necessarily with the party that they've left in disgust and despair. But you know, there are other parties that Labour might want to go into coalition, say Plaid Cymru, for example. So I think I just think the idea of tying your hands in any way before you enter a negotiating period just doesn't seem like good practice to me.
So do you think it's tribalists on both sides just trying to kind of shore up their position then?
I think there is a worry from some within Labour that we do not want to be seen tainted by any sense that we're interested in working with the Liberal Democrats. I think, as Ian has said, the Liberal Democrats, I don't know, I think we're looking at the Liberal Democrats losing at least 20 seats. And if they lost at least 20 seats, which is a considerable portion of their seats, and then got to remain in government, I think that would be a real crisis in terms of the way that the public view democratic legitimacy. And I think there's a real worry in Labour that we wouldn't want to be seen as any part of that. But that doesn't mean that we should say in a manifesto, here is our negotiating position, we have no negotiating position.
One of the interesting things is if you look at who the Liberal Democrats are going to lose those seats to, if you don't get, I did a thing about 3 weeks ago. I went through all 57 Liberal Democrats seats because I am that sad.
No, I've got the same thing and I just never published it.
Ian, I read it, so I'm even sadder.
And actually, most of the losses, or the majority of the losses, would actually go to the Conservatives. Because, I mean, the seat that I fought in North Norfolk, I mean, that will remain Liberal Democrat, I think. But if it didn't, it wouldn't go to Labour. Labour would pile up votes, but they'd take them off the Liberal Democrats and let the Conservatives in. And that's the case all over the south and southwest of England.
Yeah, and I think that the Liberal Democrat vote will hold up better against the Tories than it will against Labour. Because I think, some of those Labour votes will hold their nose. Mm-hmm. But certainly the Tories will take some seats off them.
Nick, what do you think?
Firstly, it's completely ridiculous to rule out a coalition and we don't know what the result is. But I would actually favour next time round giving the party membership a vote on whether to form a coalition or not. So after Cameron, let's say we're in a position where we can actually form a government in coalition with Liberal Democrats, most likely. Once we've got the agreements or the sort of executive summary of agreement, we should probably, I put it to a vote to our members. Because one thing we're learning at the moment with a 5-year parliament is it's long enough to wait a few more weeks to form a government than we did last time.
Oh, I really hope that we don't have another 4-day madcap. And I hope that we have, you know, at least a week or two. And, you know, that was ridiculous last time. You could argue that there was a good reason for it because, you know, the markets were, you know, potentially going to start going all over the place and there was the crisis in Greece and so on. But to be honest, I think that was just an excuse. I think no matter what had been going on with the markets, I think there would still have been massive pressure from the media and the tabloid press in particular to do a deal really quickly. And, you know, you see how other countries do this, you know, and they usually take several weeks to put a deal together. The idea you can just do it in 4 days, you know, I think given that they only had 4 days, I think they actually did a pretty good job. But, that, you know, I think they could have done a better job if they'd taken their time. Stu, I just wanted to get you in on this because I remember at the time when the coalition formed, although you weren't really affiliated with any particular party, I think you thought it was, I remember you saying actually it was probably just about the best outcome for you, a coalition of the Tories and Lib Dems. Kind of 4 years on, what do you think?
That is exactly what I said at the time. And to be honest, I still don't think either Labour or the Conservatives or a Labour Liberal Democrat coalition would be preferable. You know, even with some of the bad things that the coalition has done, and you know they've done bad things and good things over that time, and like I've completely lost interest in politics over that time, partly because it just got so boring for about 2 years after the election. But no, I still stand by that. I have no major problems with the coalition as it stands, and I think that kind of it's given David Cameron a way of sort of fending off the extreme right wing of his party that would maybe get him losing government by the next election. And at the same time, you know, it's given us the sort of government that I was kind of hoping for. So I can't say that I'm massively critical of the coalition. To be honest, that's part of the reason that I kind of gave up blogging is, you know, when Labour were around, when Gordon Brown was around, you know, you had something you could really sink your teeth into. And, you know, it just didn't feel like you did for the first couple of years of the coalition government.
I'm sure it didn't feel like you did.
Yes, yeah, okay, I didn't feel like I did. In terms of the question, I think it would be absolutely ridiculous for any party to rule out a coalition at this point before an election. I remember back in 2010, it seeming like no party was going to get an overall majority, and Nick Clegg was being asked sort of every week, you know, would he form a coalition with Labour? Would he form a coalition with the Tories? And he was very tight-lipped about it, saying, you know, if it happens, it happens. You know, we'll talk about it at the time when the election maths works out that way. And I think he actually played that game very well. You know, obviously being in government has cost the Lib Dems quite a lot of their credibility, which is, I think, a kind of inevitable fact of turning into a party of government. But, you know, as it stands, it would be ridiculous for any party in advance of any kind of election to just flatly say, you know, whatever happens, we won't go into a coalition, because that's basically saying, you know, we're not interested in actually being in government, even in a limited sense. When, you know, we and then at that point, what do you stand for?
Okay. Does anyone else have anything to say on this before we wrap up? I'm hearing silence.
Yeah. Oh, can I congratulate you, Mark, for not mentioning electoral reform in the answer to that question?
Well, I thought
you had that to was, do that.
That was extreme. That was extremely impressive. Yeah, I noticed that one as well. I
impressive discipline there.
I wasn't expecting that the only person to mention that on the podcast be the Conservative, Nick, I have to say, but there you go. So yes, I thought it's the 100th episode. It's a, you know, it's a celebration. You know, let's not get it bogged down with the usual stuff that I come out
it's
with.
It's not greatest hits.
Yeah, I'll save that for the next episode I'm on, when I'll rant on about it as usual. Okay, well, it just remains for me to thank our guest tonight. So thanks to Emma, to Nick, to Ian, and to Stu for coming on. It's been great to have you all on. It's been great to have you back, Stu. Have we tempted you back into the politics field again with this last 40 minutes?
It's been great fun, Mark, but I'm not sure I could do it every week.
Just been a bit of a blast from the past for you.
Yeah, it's been, do you know, I think, can you call this now the longest running independent political UK podcast?
Well, we had a hiatus for 2 years, so I'm not sure we can really do that. It probably is.
Does it matter? Been going for 4 or 5 years now?
Yeah, about 4.5 years. I mean, the strange thing is that actually when we started, Stu, if you remember, there were really no other political podcasts the UK.
No,
at least not regular ones. I think Jonathan Shepherd used to do occasional ones, and I think he used to do one with you, didn't he, Ian? But,
yeah, he did. It used to be just me swearing most of the time.
Yes,
I did get a cult audience because people couldn't believe that I could say fuck on the on a podcast.
You're allowed to say that on this.
I just did.
Yeah, Emma managed to say an even ruder swear word a couple of times when we had Toby Young on a few weeks ago. So, yes. But now there are loads of political podcasts, and I think that's great. You know, I think that the more the merrier, really. But it does mean that we're competing with a much wider pool these days. So
I think you've been doing very well with it, Mark. I'm very glad to hear it continuing, and I have been listening.
Oh, good.
And you get lots of great guests on and things, and okay. So yeah.
Oh, yeah, not half as good as I do on LBC, though.
Oh, Ian. Well, maybe we'll get you on again at some point then, Ian.
If that,
you
can... that would be lovely. Weeknight 4 to 8, by the way.
Yes.
All over the country.
I was going to ask you, actually, Ian, do you think that your elevation to your kind of exalted position now, how much do you think your guest spots on the House of Comments a few years ago kind of contributed to that?
I think they played an absolutely crucial role, if I'm honest.
Yeah, that's what I thought you'd say. Yeah,
that's what I've been told.
Good stuff. Okay. Well, on that bombshell, we will wrap up the 100th episode. So thanks again to my guests, and it just remains for me to thank Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music, and Audio Boo for hosting the podcast on the internet. And next week, Emma will be back hosting an episode.